Someone was writing in the gloom, the scratching of their pen the only sound, until a door creaked open. The writer turned as quick as a bird. "You? I told you never to come back here." I know, but it's that damn thing. The production line stopped and it got out and it's killed that priest. Did anyone see it? And the fog we had last night? I shouldn't think so, but then it is not a matter of significance. No, they're not supposed to kill people. Well, that is, the speaker conceded, not by smashing them on the head anyway. They will if so instructed. I never told it to. Anyway, what if it turns on me? On its master? It can't disobey the words in its head, man. The visitor sat down, shaking his head. Yeah, but which words? I don't know. This is getting too much. That damn thing around all the time. Making you a fat prophet. All right. But this other stuff, the poison, I never... Shut up. I'll see you again tonight. You can tell the others that I certainly do have a candidate. And if you dare come here again... The Ankh-Morpork Royal College of Heralds turned out to be a great... turned out to be a green gate in a wall in Mollymauk Street. Vimes tugged on the bell pull. Something clanged on the other side of the wall, and immediately the place erupted in a cacophony of hoots, growls, whistles, and trumpetings. A voice shouted, "Down, boy! Couchant! I said couchant! No, not rampant! Not rampant! And thee shall have a sugar lump like a good boy. William, stop that at once! Put him down! Mildred, let go of Graham!" The animal noises subsided a bit, and footsteps approached. A wicket gate in the main door opened a fraction. Vimes saw an inch-wide segment of a very short man. "Yes? Are you the meat man?" "Commander Vimes," said Vimes. "I have an appointment." The animal noises started up again. "Eh? Commander Vimes!" Vimes shouted. "Oh, I suppose these had better come in. Thee'd better come in." The door swung open. Vimes stepped through. Silence fell. Several dozen pairs of eyes regarded Vimes with acute suspicion. Some of the eyes were small and red. Several were big and poked, just above the surface of the scummy pond, and that occupied a lot of space in the yard. Some were on purchase. The yard was full of animals, and even they were crowded out by the smell of a yard full of animals, and most of them were clearly very old, which didn't do anything for the smell. A toothless lion yawned at Vimes. A lion running, or at least lounging around loose, was amazing in itself, but not so amazing as the fact that it was being used as a cushion by an elderly griffin, which was asleep with all four claws in the air. There were hedgehogs, and a graying leopard, and molting pelicans. Green water surged in the pond, and a couple of hippos surfaced and yawned. Nothing was in a cage, and nothing was trying to eat anything else. Ah, it takes people like that, first time, said the old man. He had a wooden leg. We're quite a happy little family. Vimes turned and found himself looking at a small owl. My gods, he said, that's a Morpork, isn't it? The old man's face broke into a happy smile. Ah, I can see thee knows thy heraldry, he cackled. Daphne's ancestors came all the way from some island on the other side of the hub, so they did. Vimes took out his badge and stared at the coat of arms embossed thereon. The old man looked over his shoulder. That's not her, of course, he said, indicating the owl perched on the Ankh. That was her great-grandma, Olive. A Morpork on an Ankh, see? That is a pun or a play on words. Laugh? I nearly started. That's about as funny as you get around here. We could do with a mate for her, tell you the truth. And a female hippo. I mean, his lordship says we've got two hippos, which is right enough. I'm just saying it's not natural for Roderick and Keith. I ain't passing judgment. It's just not right. That's all I'm saying. What was thy name again? Vimes. Sir Samuel Vimes. My wife made the appointment. The old man cackled again. Ah, 'tis usually so. Moving quite fast, despite his wooden leg, the old man led the way through the steaming mountains of multi-species dung and to the building on the other side of the yard. I expect this is good for the garden anyway, said Vimes, trying to make conversation. I tried it on my rhubarb, said the old man, pushing open the door. But it grew to 20 feet tall, sir, and then spontaneously caught fire. Mind where the wyvern's been, sir. He's been ill. Oh, what a shame. Never mind, it'll scrape off beautiful when it dries. In thee goes, sir. The hall inside was quiet and dark, as the yard had been full of light and noise. There was the dried tombstone smell of old books and church towers. Above him, when his eyes got used to the darkness, Vimes could make out hanging flags and banners. There were a few windows, but cobwebs and dead flies meant that the light they allowed in was merely gray. The old man had shut the door and left him alone. Vimes watched through the window as he limped back to continue what he was doing before Vimes's appearance. What he had been doing was setting up a living coat of arms. There was a large shield. Cabbages, actual cabbages, had been nailed to it. The old man said something that Vimes couldn't hear. The little owl fluttered in from its perch and landed on a large ankh that had been glued to the top of the shield. The two hippos floated out of their pool and took up station on either side. The old man unfolded an easel in front of the scene, placed a canvas on it, picked up a palette and brushed, and shouted, "Hopla!" The hippos reared, rather arthritically. The owl spread its wings. "Good gods," murmured Vimes. "I always thought they just made it up." "Made it up, sir. Made it up," said a voice behind him. "We'd soon be in trouble if we made things up. Oh, dear me, yes." Vimes turned. Another little old man had appeared behind him, blinking happily through thick glasses. He had several scrolls under one arm. "I'm sorry I couldn't meet you at the gate, but we're very busy at the moment," he said, holding out his spare hand. "Croissant rouge persivant. You're a small red breakfast roll?" said Vimes nonplussed. No, it means red crescent. It's my title, you see. Very ancient title. I'm a herald. You'd be Sir Samuel Vimes, yes? Yes. Red Crescent consulted a scroll. Good. "How do you feel about weasels?" he said. "Weasels? We have got some weasels, you see. I know they're not strictly a heraldic animal, but we seem to have some on the strength, and frankly, I think I'm going to have to let them go unless we can persuade someone to adopt them. And that'd upset Pardessus, Chetan Percivant. He always locks himself in his shed when he's upset." "Pardessus, you mean the old man out there?" said Vimes. "A coat of arms is just a design. You don't have to paint it from life." Red Crescent looked shocked. "Well, I suppose if you want to make a complete mockery of the whole thing, yes, you could just make it up." "You could do that," he said. "Anyway, not weasels, then." "Personally, I just as soon not bother," said Vimes, "and certainly not with a weasel. My wife said that dragons would..." "Happily, the occasion will not arise," said a voice in the shadows. It wasn't the right sort of voice to hear in any kind of light. It was dust dry. It sounded as if it came from a mouth that had never known the pleasures of spittle. It sounded dead. It was. The bakery thieves considered their options. "I've got my hand on my crossbow," said the most enterprising of the three. The most realistic said, "Have you? Well, I've got my heart in my mouth." "Ooh," said the third, "I've got a weak heart, me." "Yeah, but what I mean is, he's not even wearing a sword. If I take the wolf, the two of you should be able to deal with him with no trouble, right?" The one clear thinker looked at Captain Carrot. His armor shone. So did the muscles on his bare arms. Even his knees gleamed. "It seems to me that we have a bit of an impasse or standoff," said Carrot. "How about if we throw down the money?" said the clear thinker. "That would certainly help matters. And you'd let us go?" "No, but it would definitely count in your favor, and I would certainly speak up on your behalf." The bold one with the crossbow licked his lips and glanced from Carrot to the wolf. "If you set it on us, I warn you, someone's going to get killed," he warned. "Yes, it could happen," said Carrot sadly. "I prefer to avoid that, if at all possible." He raised his hands. There was something flat and round and about 6 inches across in each one. This, he said, "is dwarf bread, some of Mr. Ironcrest's best. It's not classic battle bread, of course, but it's probably good enough for slicing." Carrot's arm blurred. There was a brief flurry of sawdust, and the flat loaf spun to a stop halfway through the thick timbers of the cart and about half an inch away from the man with the weak heart. And, as it turned out, a fragile bladder, too. The man with the crossbow tore his attention away from the bread only when he felt a slight damp pressure on his wrist. There was no way that an animal could have moved that fast. But there it was, and the wolf's expression contrived to indicate very calmly that if the animal so desired, the pressure could be increased more or less indefinitely. "Call it off," he said, flinging the bow away from his friend, free hand. "Tell it to let go." "Oh, I never tell her anything," said Carrot. "She makes up her own mind." There was a clatter of iron chomp boots, and half a dozen axe-bearing dwarfs raced out of the bakery gates, kicking out sparks as they skidded to a halt beside Carrot. "Get them," shouted Mr. Ironcrest. Carrot dropped a hand on top of the dwarf's helmet and turned him around. "It's me, Mr. Ironcrest," he said. "I believe these are the men." "Right you are, Captain Carrot," said the dwarf baker. "Come on, lads, let's hang him up by the Burazaka." "Ooh," murmured the weak of heart damply. Now, Mr. Ironcrest," said Carrot patiently. "We don't practice that punishment in Ankh-Morpork. They bashed Bjorn tight breeches senseless, and they kicked Olaf Strong in the arm in the Badocks. We'll cut their Mr. Ironcrest." The dwarf baker hesitated, and then, to the amazement and relief of the thieves, took a step backwards. "Yeah, all right, Captain Carrot, if you say so. I have business elsewhere, but I would be grateful if you would take them and turn them over to the Thieves Guild," said Carrot. The quick thinker went pale. "Oh no, they get really intense about unlicensed thieving." "Anything but the Thieves Guild," Carrot turned. The light caught at his face in a certain way. "Anything?" he said. The unlicensed thieves looked at one another, and then all spoke at once. "The Thieves Guild, fine, no problem. We like the Thieves Guild, can't wait. Thieves Guild, here I come. Fine body of men, firm but fair." "Good," said Carrot. "Then everyone's happy." "Oh, yes." He dug into his money pouch. "Here's 5 pence for the loaf, Mr. Ironcrest. I've handled the other one, but you should be able to sand it off with no trouble." The dwarf blinked at the coins. "You want to pay me for saving my money?" he said. "As a taxpayer, you are entitled to the protection of the watch," said Carrot. There was a delicate pause. Mr. Ironcrest stared at his feet. One or two of the other dwarfs started to snigger. "I'll tell you what," said Carrot, in a kindly voice. "I'll come around when I got a moment and help you fill in the forms. How about that?" A thief broke the embarrassed silence. "Could your little dog let go of my arm, please?" The wolf released its grip, jumped down, and padded over to Carrot. He raised his hand to his helmet respectfully. "Good day to you all," he said, and strode away. Thieves and victims watched him go. "Is he real?" said the quick thinker. There was a growl from the baker. Then, "You bastards," he shouted. "You bastards. What? You've got the money back, haven't you?" Two of his employees had to hold Mr. Ironcuffs back. "3 years," he said. "3 years, and no one bothered. 3 bloody years, and not so much as a knock at the door. And he'll ask me. Oh, yes, he'll be nice about it. He'll probably even go and get the extra forms so I won't be put to the trouble. Why couldn't you buggers have just run away?" Vimes peered around the shadow, musty room. The voice
might as well have come from a tomb. A panicky look crossed the face of the little hill.
"Perhaps Sir Samuel would be kind enough to step this way," said the voice. It was chilly, clipping every syllable with precision. It was the kind of voice that didn't blink.
"That is, in fact, our dragon," said the Red Crescent.
Vimes reached for his sword.
"Dragon King of Arms," said the man.
"King of Arms?" said Vimes.
"Merely a title," said the voice. "Pray enter."
For some reason, the words respelled themselves in Vimes' hindbrain as "Pray enter."
"King of Arms," said the voice of Dragon, as Vimes passed into the shadow of the inner sanctum.
"You will not need your sword, Commander. I have been Dragon King of Arms for more than 500 years, but I do not breathe fire, I assure you."
"Aha, aha, aha," said Vimes. He couldn't see the figure clearly.
The light came from a few high and grubby windows and several dozen candles that burned with black-edged flames. There was a suggestion of hunched shoulders in the shape before him.
"Pray be seated," said Dragon King of Arms,
"and I would be most indebted if you would look to your left and raise your chin."
"And expose my neck, you mean," said Vimes.
"Aha, aha." The figure picked up a candelabrum and moved closer. A hand so skinny as to be skeletal gripped Vimes' chin and moved it gently this way and that.
"Ah, yes. You have the Vimes profile, certainly, but not the Vimes ears. Of course, your maternal grandmother was a clamp.
Uh-huh."
The Vimes hand gripped the Vimes sword again. There was only one type of person that had that much strength in a body so apparently frail.
"I thought so. You are a vampire," he said.
"You're a bloody vampire.
Aha."
It might have been a laugh. It might have been a cough.
"Yes, a vampire indeed.
Yes, I've heard about your views on vampires.
Not really alive, but not dead enough.
I believe you have said.
I think that is rather clever."
"Aha. Vampires, yes. Bloody,
no. Black puddings, yes.
The acme of the butcher's art, yes. And if all else fails, there are plenty of kosher butchers down in Long Cog Meat.
"Aha, yes.
We all live in the best way we can.
Aha. Virgins are safe from me.
Aha. For several hundred years, more's the pity.
Aha."
The shape in the pool of candlelight moved away.
"I'm afraid your time has been needlessly wasted, Commander Vimes."
Vimes' eyes were growing accustomed to the flickering light. The room was full of books, in piles. None of them were on shelves. Each one sprouted bookmarks like squashed fingers.
"I don't understand," he said. "Either Dragon King of Arms has had very hunched shoulders, or there were wings under his shapeless robe."
"Some of them could fly like a bat," Vimes recalled. He wondered how old this one was. "They could live almost forever."
I believe you're here because it is considered appropriate that you have a coat of arms.
I'm afraid that is not possible. That this is not possible.
A Vimes coat of arms has existed, but it cannot be resurrected. It would be against the rules.
What rules?
There was a thump as a book was taken down and opened.
I'm sure you know your ancestry, Commander. Your father was Thomas Vimes. His father was Gwilliam Vimes. It's Old Stoneface, isn't it? Said Vimes flatly. It's something to do with Old Stoneface. Indeed, aha. Suffer not injustice, Vimes. Your ancestor, Old Stoneface. Indeed, as he was called. Commander of the City Watch in 1688. And a regicide. He murdered the last king of Ankh-Morpork, as every schoolboy knows. Executed. The shoulders shrugged. Nevertheless, the family crest was, as we say in heraldry, excretus est ex altitudin. That is to say, depositatum de latrina. Destroyed. Banned. Made incapable of resurrection. Lands confiscated. Houses pulled down. Page torn out of history. Aha. You know, Commander, it is interesting that so many of Old Stoneface's descendants, the inverted comma dropped neatly around the nickname, like an old lady carefully picking up something nasty in a pair of tongs, have been officers of the watch. I believe, Commander, that you too have acquired the nickname. Aha, aha. I have wondered whether there is some inherited urge to expunge the infamy. Aha. Vimes gritted his teeth. Are you telling me I can't have a coat of arms? This is so, aha. Because my ancestor killed a... He paused. No, it wasn't even execution, he said. You execute a human being. You slaughter an animal. He was the king, said Dragon mildly. And, yes. Oh, yes. And it turns out the down in the dungeons he had machines for it. Commander, said the vampire, holding up his hands. I feel you do not understand me. Whatever else he was the king. You see, a crown is not like a watchman's helmet. Uh-huh. Even when you take it off, it's still on the head. Stoneface took it off all right. But the king did not even get a trial. No willing judge could be found, said Vimes. Except you, that is, your ancestor. Well, Stoneface Vimes had to do it. Some monster should not walk under the living city. Dragon found the page he had been looking for and turned the book around. This was his escutcheon, he said. Vimes looked down at the familiar sign of the Morpork owl perched on an oak. It was atop a shield divided into four quarters with a symbol in each quarter. What's this crown with a dagger through it? Oh, a traditional symbol. Indicates his role as defender of the crown. Really? And the bunch of rods with an axe in it, he pointed. A fasces symbolizes that he was an officer of the law. And the axe was an interesting harbinger of things to come, yes? But axes, I'm afraid, solve nothing. Vimes stared at the third quarter. It contained a painting of what seemed to be a marble bust, symbolizing his nickname, Old Stoneface. Said Dragon helpfully. He asked that some reference be made. Sometimes heraldry is nothing more than the art of putting. And this last one, a bunch of grapes. Bit of a boozer, was he? Said Vimes sourly. Aha, no. Wordplay. Vimes equals vines. Ah, the art of bad punning, said Vimes. I bet that had you people rolling on the floor. Dragon shut the book inside. There is seldom a reward for those who do what must be done. Alas, such is precedent, and I am powerless. The old voice brightened up. But still, I was extremely pleased, Commander, to hear of your marriage to Lady Sybil. An excellent lineage, one of the most noble families in the city, aha. The Ramkins, the Salachis, the Venturis, the Nobses, of course. That's it, is it? Said Vimes. I just go now? I seldom get visitors, said Dragon. Generally, people are seen by the heralds.
But I thought you should get a proper explanation. We're so busy now. Once we dealt with real heraldry, but this, they tell me, is the century of the fruit bat. Now it seems that as soon as a man opens his second meat pie shop, he feels impelled to consider himself a gentleman. He waved a thin white hand at three coats of arms pinned in a row on a board. The butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker, he sneered. But genteelly. Well, the candle maker, in point of fact. Nothing will do but that we burrow through the records and prove them acceptably armigerous. Vimes glanced at the three shields. Haven't I seen that one before, I said, he said. Ah, Mr. Arthur Carey, the candlemaker, said Jagan. Suddenly business is booming, and he feels he must be a gentleman. A shield bisected by a bend of sinister dune mesh in metal gris. That is to say, a steel-gray shield indicating his personal determination and zeal. How's else, those businessmen are? Bisected by a wick. Upper half, a chandelle in a fenêtre avec rideau houlant. A candle lighting a window with a warm glow. Maha. Lower half, two chandeliers, illuminé, indicating the wretched man sells candles to rich and poor alike. Which fact allowed us to stretch ourselves a little with a crest of a lampe à poisson, fish-shaped lamp, indicating both this and his son's current profession. The motto I left in the common modern tongue, and is art brought forth the candle. I'm sorry, I was naughty, but I couldn't resist it. My sides ache, said Vimes. Something kicked his rein, trying to get attention. This one is for Mr. Gerhard Sock, president of the Butcher's Guild, said Dragon. His wife told him a coat of arms is a thing to have, and who are we to argue with the daughter of a tripe merchant? So we've made him a shield of red for blood, and blue and white stripes for a butcher's apron, bisected by a string of sausages. Centralis, a cleaver, held in a gloved hand, a boxing glove, which is the best we could do for Sock. Motto is futuris meus est futuris meus in viseris, which translates as my future is in the entrails. Both relating to his profession and, alluding to the old practice of telling the future from entrails, said Vimes. Amazing. Whatever was trying to get into his attention was really jumping up and down now. While this one, is for Rudolph Potts of the Baker's Guild, said Dragon, pointing to the third shield with a twig-thin finger. Can you read it, Commander? Vimes gave it a gloomy stare. Well, it's divided into three, and there's a rose, a flame, and a pot, he said. Bakers use fire, and the pot's for water, I suppose. And a pun on the name, said Dragon. But unless he's called Rosie, Then Vimes blinked. A rose and a flower. Oh, good grief. Flower, 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 fire, and water. The pot looks like a gazunder to me, though. A chamber pot? The old word for baker was pistor, said Dragon. Why, Commander, we should make a herald of you yet. And the motto? Quod subigo farinam, said Vimes, and wrinkled his forehead. Because farinaceus means to do with corn or flour, doesn't it? Oh, no, because I need the dough? Dragon clapped his hands. Well done, sir. This place must simply rock on those long winter evenings, said Vimes. And that's heraldry, is it? Crossword clues and plays on words? Of course, there is a great deal more, said the dragon. These are simple. We more or less have to make them up.
whereas the escutcheon of an old family, such as the Nobses. Nobs, said Vimes, as the penny dropped. That's it, you said Nobs before, when you were talking about old families. Uh-huh, what? Oh, indeed. Yes, oh yes, a fine old family, although now sadly in decay. You don't mean Nobs as in Corporal Nobs, said Vimes, horror edging his words. A book thumped open in the orange light. Vimes had a vague upside-down glimpse of Shields and a rambling, unpruned family tree. My word, would that be C.W. St. J. Nobs, or... Yes, yes! Son of Sconner Nobs and a lady referred to here as a Maisie of Elm Street? Probably. Grandson of Slope Nobs? That sounds about right. Who was the illegitimate son of Edward St. John de Nobs, Earl of Ankh, and, a parlor maid of unknown lineage? Good God! The Earl died without issue, except that which, resulted in Slope. We had not been able to trace the scion hitherto, at any rate. Good gods. You know the gentleman? Vimes regarded with amazement a serious and positive sentence about Corporal Nobs that included the word gentleman. Yes, he said. Is he a man of property? Only other people. So, ha ha. Do tell him. There is no land or money now, of course. But the title is still extant. Sorry. Let me make sure I understand. This Corporal Nobs, my Corporal Nobs, is the Earl of Ankh? He would have to satisfy us as to proof of his lineage, but yes, it would appear so. Vimes stared into the gloom. Thus far in his life, Corporal Nobs would have been unlikely to have satisfied the examiners as to his species. Good gods, Vimes said yet again. And I suppose he gets a coat of arms. A particularly fine one. Oh. Vimes hadn't even wanted a coat of arms. An hour ago, he'd have cheerfully avoided this appointment, as he had done so many times before. But, Nobby, he said. Good gods. Well, well. This has been a very happy meeting, said Dragon. I do so like to keep the records up to date. Aha! Incidentally, how is young Captain Carrot getting along? I'm told his young lady is a werewolf. Aha, really, said Vimes. Aha, and the dark dragon made a movement that might have been a conspiratorial tap on the side of his nose. We know these things. Captain Carrot is doing well, said Vimes, as icily as he could manage. Captain Carrot always does well. He slammed the door when he went out. The candle flames wavered. Constable Anquil walked out of an alleyway, doing up her belt. That went very well, I thought, said Carrot, and will go some way to earning us the respect of the community. That man's sleeve. I doubt if he even knows the meaning of the word laundry, said Angua, wiping her mouth. Automatically, they fell into step. The energy-saving policeman's walk. Where the pendulum weight of the leg is used to propel the walker along with the minimum of effort. Walking was important, Vimes had always said, and because Vimes had said it, Carrot believed it. Walking and talking. Walk far enough and talk to enough people, and sooner or later you had an answer. The respect of the community, thought Angua. That was a Carrot phrase. Well, in fact, it was a Vimes phrase, although Sir Samuel usually spat after he said it. But Carrot believed it. It was Carrot who'd suggested to the patrician that hardened criminals should be given the chance to serve the community by redecorating the homes of the elderly.
lending a new terror to old age and giving Ankh-Morpork's crime rate, leading to at least one old lady having her front room wallpapered so many times in 6 months that now she could only get into it sideways. I found something very interesting that you will be very interested to see, said Kara after a while. That's interesting, said Angua. But I'm not going to tell you what it is, because I want it to be a surprise, said Carrot. Oh, good. Angua walked in thought for a while, and then said, I wonder if it will be as surprising as the collection of rock samples you showed me last week. That was good, wasn't it? Said Carrot enthusiastically. I've been along that street dozens of times, and never suspected there was a mineral museum there. All those silicates... Amazing. You'd imagine people would be flocking to it, wouldn't you? Yes, I can't think why they don't. Angua reminded herself that Carrot appeared to have in his soul not even a trace element of irony. She told herself that it wasn't his fault he'd been brought up by dwarfs in some mine, and really didn't think the bits of rock were interesting. And really did think that bits of rock were interesting. The week before, they'd visited an iron foundry. That had been interesting, too. And yet, you couldn't help liking Carrot. Even people he was arresting liked Carrot. Even old ladies living in a permanent smell of fresh paint liked Carrot. She liked Carrot a lot. Which was going to make leaving him all the harder. She was a werewolf. That's all there was to it. You either spent your time trying to make sure people didn't find you out, or you let them find out and spent your time watching them keep their distance and whisper behind your back. Although, of course, you'd have to turn around to watch that. Karen didn't mind, but he minded that other people minded. He minded that even quite friendly colleagues tended to carry a bit of silver somewhere on their person. She could see it upsetting him. She could see the tensions building up, and he didn't know how to deal with them. It was just as her father had said. Get involved with humans, humans other than at mealtimes, and you might as well jump down a silver mine. Apparently, there's going to be a huge firework display after the celebrations next year, said Carrot. I like fireworks. It beats me why Ankh-Morpork wants to celebrate the fact it had a civil war 300 years ago, said Angua, coming back to the herald, to the here and now. Why not? We won, said Carrot. Yes, but you lost, too. Always look on the positive side. That's what I say. Ah, here we are. Angua looked up at the sign. She'd learned to read dwarf runes now. Dwarf Bread Museum, she said. Gosh, I can't wait. Carrot nodded happily and pushed open the door. There was a smell of ancient crust. Cooey, Mr. Hopkinson? He said. He called. There was no reply. He does go out sometimes, he said. Probably when the excitement gets too much for him, said Angua. Hopkinson, that's not a dwarf name, is it? Oh, he's a human, said Carrot, stepping inside. But an amazing authority. Bread's his life. He wrote the definitive work on offensive baking. Well, since he's not here, I'll just take two tickets and leave tuppence on the desk. It didn't look as though Mr. Hopkinson got many visitors. There was dust on the floor, and dust on the display cases, and a lot of dust on the exhibits. Most of them were the classic cowpat-like shape, an echo of their taste. But there were also buns, close combat crumpets, deadly throwing toast, and a huge dusty array of other shapes devised by a race that went in for food fighting in a big and above all terminal way. What are we looking for? Angua said. She sniffed. There was a nastily familiar tang in the air. It's
Are you ready for this? The battle bred of Burian blood axe, said Carrot, rummaging in a desk by the entrance. A loaf of bread? You brought me here to see a loaf of bread? She sniffed again. Yes, blood. Fresh blood. That's right, said Carrot. It's only going to be here a couple of weeks on loan. It's the actual bread he personally wielded at the Battle of Goom Valley, killing 57 trolls, although... And here Carrot's tone changed down from enthusiasm to civic respectability. That was a long time ago, and we shouldn't let ancient history blind us to the realities of a multi-ethnic society in the century of the fruit bat. There was a creak of a door. Then, this battle bread, said Angua indistinctly. Black, isn't it? Quite a lot bigger than normal bread? Yes, that's right, said Carrot. And Mr. Hopkinson, a short man? Little white pointy beard? That's him. And his head all smashed in? What? I think you better come and look, said Angua, backing away. Dragon, king of arms, sat alone among his candles. So that was Commander Sir Samuel Vimes, he mused. Stupid man, clearly can't see beyond the chip on his shoulder. And people like that rise to high office these days. Still, such people have their uses, which presumably is why Veterinary had elevated him. Stupid men are often capable of things the clever would not dare to contemplate. He sighed and pulled another tome toward him. It was not much bigger than many others, which lined his study, a fact which might have surprised anyone who knew its contents. He was rather proud of it. It was quite an unusual piece of work, but he had been surprised, or would have been surprised, had Dragon been really surprised at anything at all for the last 100 years or so, at how easily some of it had been. He didn't even need to read it now. He knew it by heart. The family trees were properly planted. The words were down there on the page, and all he had to do was sing along. The first page was headed, The Descent of King Carrot the First, by the grace of the gods, King of Ankh-Morpork. A long and complex family tree occupied the next dozen pages until it reached Married, open parentheses, close parentheses. The words there were merely penciled in. Delphine Angua von Uberwald, said Dragon aloud. Father and, aha, sire, Baron Guy von Uberwald, also known as Silvertail. Mother, Madame Seraphine Sachs-Blumberg, also known as Yellowfang, of Genoa. It had been quite an achievement, that part. He had expected his agents to have had some difficulty with the more lupine areas of Angua's ancestry. But it turned out the mountain wolves took quite a lot of interest in that sort of thing as well. Angua's ancestors had definitely been among the leaders of the pack. Dragon King of Arms grinned. As far as he was concerned, species was a secondary consideration. What really mattered in an individual was a good pedigree. Ah, well, that was the future as it might have been. He pushed the book aside. One of the advantages of a life much longer than average was that you saw how fragile the future was. Men said things like peace in our time or an empire that will last 1,000 years. And less than half of a lifetime later, no one even remembered who they were, let alone what they had said or where the mob had buried their ashes. What changed history were smaller things. Often a few strokes of the pen would do the trick. He pulled another tome toward him. The front piece bore the words, The Descent of King... ... Now, what would the man call himself? That at least was not calculable. Oh, well. Dragon picked up his pencil and wrote Knobs. He smiled in the candlelit room. People kept on talking about the true king of Ankh-Morpork, but history taught a cruel lesson. It said, often in words of blood, that the true king was the one who got crowned. Books filled to this room, too. That was the first impression, one of dank, oppressive bookishness. The late Father Tubalcheck was sprawled across a drift of fallen books. He was certainly dead. No one could have bled that much and still been alive, or survived for long with a head like a deflated football. Someone must have hit him with a lump hammer. "This old lady came running out screaming," said Constable Visit Saluting. "So I went in, and it was just like this, sir."
"Just like this, Constable Visit?"
"Yes, sir."
"And the name's Visit, the infidel with explanatory pamphlets, sir."
"Who was the old lady?"
"She says she's Mrs. Kanaki, sir. She says she always brings him his meals. She says she does
for him."
"Does for him, you know, cleaning and sweeping."
There was indeed a tray on the floor, along with a broken bowl and some spilled porridge. The lady who did for the old man had been shocked to find that someone else had done for him first.
"Did she touch him?" he said.
"She says not, sir."
Which means the old priest had somehow achieved the neatest death Vimes had ever seen. His hands were crossed on his chest, his eyes had been closed, and something had been put in his mouth. It looked like a rolled up piece of paper. It gave the corpse a disconcertingly jaunty look, as though he decided to have a last cigarette after dying. Vimes gingerly picked out the little scroll and unrolled it. It was covered with meticulously written but unfamiliar symbols. What made them particularly noteworthy was the fact that their author had apparently made use of the only liquid lying around in huge quantities.
"Yuck," said Vimes, "written in blood. Does this mean anything to anyone?"
"Yes, sir." Vimes rolled his eyes.
"Yes, Constable Visit?"
"Visit the infidel with explanatory pamphlets, sir," said Constable Visit, looking hurt.
"The infidel with explanatory pamphlets. I was just about to say it, Constable," said Vimes.
"Well?"
"It's an ancient Clachian script," said Constable Visit. "One of the desert tribes called the Sinotines, sir. They had a sophisticated but fundamentally flawed..."
"Yes, yes, yes," said Vimes, who could recognize the verbal foot getting ready to stick itself in the aural door.
"But do you know what it means?"
"I can find out, sir."
"Good. Incidentally, were you able by any chance to find time to have a look at those leaflets I gave you the other day, sir?"
"Been very busy," said Vimes automatically.
"Not to worry, sir," said Visit, and smiled the wan smile of those doing good against great odds.
"When you've got a moment, we'll be fine."
The old books have been knocked from the shelves, had spilled their pages everywhere. There were splashes of blood on many of them.
"Some of these look religious," Vimes said.
"You might find something." He turned detritus. "Have a look around, will you?"
Detritus paused in the act of laboriously drawing a chalk outline around the body.
"Yes, sir. What for, sir?"
"Anything you find."
"Right, sir." With a grunt, Vimes hunkered down and prodded at a gray smear on the floor.
"Dirt," he said.
"You get that on floor, sir," said Detritus helpfully.
"Except this is off-white."
"We're on black loam," said Vimes.
"Ah," said the Sergeant Detritus. "A clue. Could be just dirt, of course.
There was something else. Someone had made an attempt to tidy up the books. They'd stacked several dozen of them on one neat towering pile, one book wide, largest book on the bottom, all the edges squared up with geometrical precision.
Now that I don't understand," said Vimes. "There's a fight. The old man is viciously attacked. Then someone, maybe it was him, dying, maybe it was the murderer,
writes something down using the poor man's own blood and rolls it up neatly and pops it in his mouth like a sweetie. Then he does die and someone shuts his eyes and makes him tidy and piles these books up neatly and does what? Walks out into the seething hurly-burly that is Ankh-Morpork?
Sergeant Detritus's honest brow furrowed with the effort of thought. Could be there's a footprint outside their window, he said. That's always a clue worth looking for. Vimes sighed. Detritus, despite a room temperature IQ, made a good copper and a damn good sergeant. He had that special type of stupidity that was hard to fool. But the only thing more difficult than getting him to grasp an idea was getting him to let go of it. Detritus, he said, as kindly as possible. There's a 30-foot drop into the river outside the window. This was the River Ankh, after all. Any footprints would be bound to have oozed back by now, he corrected himself, almost certainly. He looked outside, though, just in case. The river gurgled and sucked below him. There were no footprints, even on its famously crusted surface. But there was another smear of dirt on the windowsill. Vimes scratched some up and sniffed at it. Looks like some more white clay, he said. He couldn't think of any white clay around the city. Once he got outside the walls, it was thick black loam all the way to the rooftops. A man walking across it would be 2 inches taller by the time he got to the other side of a field. White clay, he said. Where the hell is white clay country around here? It a mystery, said Detritus. Vimes grinned mirthlessly. It was a mystery, and he didn't like mysteries. Mysteries had a way of getting bigger if you didn't solve them quickly. Mysteries pupped. Mere murders happened all the time, and usually even Detritus could solve them. When a distraught woman was standing over a fallen husband holding a right-angled poker and crying, he never should have said that about our Neville. There was only a limited amount you could do to spin out the case beyond the next coffee break. And when various men or parts thereof were hanging from or nailed to various fixtures in the mended drum on a Saturday night, and the other clientele were all looking innocent, you didn't need even a Detritic intelligence to work out what had been happening. He looked down at the late Father Tubalcheck. It was amazing he'd bled so much. With his pipe cleaner arms and toast rack chest, he certainly wouldn't have been able to put up much of a fight. Vimes leaned down and gently raised one of the corpse's eyelids. A milky blue eye with a black center looked back at him from wherever the old priest was now. A religious old man was living in a couple of little pokey rooms and obviously didn't get out much from the smell. What kind of treat could he? Constable Visit poked his head around the door. There's a dwarf down here with no eyebrows and a frizzled beard. Says you told him to come, sir, he said. And some citizens say Father Tubalcheck is their priest, and they want to bury him decently. Ah, that'll be Little Poppin. Send him up. And Vimes, said Vimes, straightening. Tell the others they'll have to wait. Little Bottom climbed the stairs, took in the scene, and managed to reach the window in time to be sick. Better now, said Vimes eventually. Yes, I hope so. I'll leave you to it, then. What exactly did you want me to do? Said Little Bottom. But Vimes was already halfway down the stairs. Angua growled. It was the signal to Carrot that he could open his eyes again. Women, as Colin had remarked to Carrot once when he thought the lad needed advice, could be funny about little things. Maybe they didn't like to be seen without their makeup on or insisted buying smaller suitcases than many, even though they always took more clothes. In Angua's case, she didn't like to be seen en route from human to werewolf shape, or vice versa. It was just something she had a thing about, she said. Kara could see her in either shape, but not in the various ones she occupied on the way through. In case he never wanted to see her again. Through werewolf eyes, the world was different, for one thing. It was in black and white. At least, that small part of it, which, as a human, she thought of as vision, was monochrome. But who cared that vision had to take a back seat when smell drove instead? Laughing and sticking its arm out of the window and making rude gestures at all the other senses. Afterward, she always remembered the odors, as colors and sounds. Blood was rich brown and deep brass. Stale bread was a surprisingly tinkly bright blue. And every human being with a four-dimensional kaleidoscope symphony. For nasal vision meant seeing through time as well as space. Man could stand still for a minute, and an hour later, there he'd still be. To the nose, his odors barely faded. She prowled the aisles of the Dwarf Bread Museum, muzzle to the ground. Then she went out into the alley for a while and tried there too. After 5 minutes, she padded back to Karen and gave him the signal again. When he reopened his eyes, she was pulling her shirt on over her head. That was one thing where humans had the edge. You couldn't beat a pair of hands. "I thought you'd be down the street and following someone," he said. "Follow who?" said Angua. "Pardon? I can smell him, and you, and the bread, and that's it. Nothing else? Dirt, dust, the usual stuff. Oh, there are some old traces, days old. I know you were in here last week, for example. There are lots of smells. Grease, meat, pine, resin, for some reason. Old food. But I'll swear no living thing's been in here in the last day or so." "But him and us." "But you told me everyone leaves a trail." "They do." Kara looked down at the late curator. However you phrased it, however badly you applied your definitions, he definitely couldn't have committed suicide. Not with a loaf of bread. "Vampires," said Kara. "They can fly," Angua sighed. "Kara, I could tell if a vampire had been here in the last month. There's almost half a dollar in pennies in the drawer," said Kara. "Anyway, a thief would be here for the battle bread, wouldn't they? It is a very valuable cultural artifact. "Has the poor man got any relatives?" said Angua. He's got an elderly sister, I believe. I come in once a month to have a chat. He lets me handle the exhibits, you know." "That must be fun," said Angua before she could stop herself. "It's very satisfying, yes," said Carrot solemnly. "It reminds me of home." Angua sighed and stepped into the room behind the little museum. It was like the back room of museums everywhere, full of junk and things there is no room for on the shelves, and also items of doubtful provenance, such as coins dated 52... dot dot dot. Or... oh, 52 BC. There were some benches with shards of dwarf bread on them, a tidy tool racked with various sizes of kneading hammer, and papers all over the place. Against one wall and occupying a large part of the room was an oven. "He researches old recipes," said Carrot,
who seemed to feel he had to promote the old man's expertise even to death, even in death. Angua opened the oven door. Warmth spilled out into the room. "Hell of a bake oven," she said. "What are these things?" "Ah, see, he's been making drop scones," said Carrot. "Quite deadly at short range." She shut the door. "Let's get back to the yard, and they can send someone out to Angua stop. Just, there were always the dangerous moments, just after a shape change, this close to full moon. It wasn't so bad when she was a wolf. She was still as intelligent, or at least she felt as intelligent, although life was a lot simpler, and so she was probably just extremely intelligent for a wolf. It was when she became a human again that things were difficult, for a few minutes, until the morphic field fully reasserted itself. All her senses were still keen. Smells were still incredibly strong, and her ears could hear some sounds way outside the stunted human range. And she could think more about the things she experienced. A wolf could sniff a lamppost and know about the old bonzo had been passed yesterday. And was feeling a bit under the weather. And was still feeling being fed tripe by his owner. But a human mind could actually think about the whys and wherefores. "There is something else," she said. And breathed in gently. "Faint, not a living thing. But can't you smell it? Something like dirt, but not quite. It's kind of yellow-orange," said Carrot tactfully. "Some of us don't have your nose. I smelled it before, somewhere in this town. Can't remember where. It's strong, stronger than the other smells. It's a muddy smell. Ha, well, on these streets. No, it's not exactly mud. Sharper, more trouble. You know, sometimes I envy you. It must be nice to be a wolf, just for a while." "It has its drawbacks, like fleas," she thought, as they locked up the museum. "And the food, and the constant nagging feeling that you should be wearing 3 bras at once." She kept telling herself she had it under control, and she did, in a way. She prowled the city on moonlit nights, and okay, there was the occasional chicken. But she always remembered where she'd been and went round next day to shove some money under the door. It was hard to be a vegetarian who had to pick bits of meat out of her teeth in the morning. She was definitely on top of it, though. Definitely, she reassured herself. It was Angua's mind that prowled the night, not a werewolf mind. She was almost entirely sure of that. A werewolf wouldn't stop at chickens, and not by a long way. She shuddered. Who was she kidding? It was easy to be a vegetarian by day. It was preventing yourself being a humanitarian at night that took the real effort.